Hello, everyone. Welcome. My name is Flash Rosenberg, and I'm artist in residence for Live from the New York Public Library. You may be thinking, an artist in residence? What on earth would somebody like that do? Well, it happened because I was you. I was in the audience, and I was struck by how these live programs are more than just lectures, that something very active happens. And it's not just visible. I mean, yeah, people are sitting out there. People are sitting up here. It looks like a lecture. But in this room, there's a kind of new energy for what could be happening during discussions. So conversations here happen not just on stage, but between strangers sitting next to each other and within each person. I draw how I understand the talks. What I draw are not caricatures. It's not court reporting. At times, it's not even accurate. It's like being a listener. I want to capture how the ideas look. I call my work conversation portraits. I combine text with the doodling because I write the words until the alphabet is insufficient, and then I make it more abstract. It becomes drawing. Then the drawing needs to be more specific, and so it goes back into words. So you'll see it undulating. Tonight I'll be drawing the conversation between the panelists and that strange equipment in the back that you were all sort of grunting at as you had to walk past it. The drawing is being videotaped as it occurs, and then later on I edit it to get the key moments to match up with the audio so that you can see something like the next two animations that I'm going to be presenting. You're going to see them representing live conversations that happened before from talks you may have missed, and you'll be seeing a little bit of what is being created tonight. Thank you.
It was absolutely wonderful. Thank you, Flash. I felt as though I was there for that conversation that Paul led. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we come to the concluding panel of our Islam in Europe program. And it's been a really exciting, enlightening series of sessions with very, very intelligent questions afterwards. It's been really a joy to be here. I'd like to, before we bring our panelists on, thank our very generous host, Paul Holdengraber, the director of the New York Public Library Live. Thank you, Paul. I'd also like to thank the European Union National Institutes for Culture and the head of that network, Gabriel Becker. Thank you, Gabby. Our compadre in this adventure, Martin Rauschbauer and Mahnaz Fancy. Thank you very much. It's been wonderful working with you. It's been a really remarkable partnership over a very important issue, Islam in Europe, and with its subtitle, Insult, Fractured States. And this exploration of how we got here, the history, the colonization, the immigration, and how those elements played into migration and policy, the response, the reaction, which is now the status quo, and also looking at the future, the youth, and how young people can really help shape what happens in Europe and the world. And many of you were here for the media panel, which was also very lively, how media can serve as a catalyst for change. So the question is, where do we go from here? We are fragile and imperfect creatures, and very often when we are pushed, we become desperate. We're not born desperate, we become desperate. And in that desperation, we do one of two things. We either turn towards rather negative and sometimes violent action, the results of which we all know here. And we can also help to launch movements and channel that desperation in a very positive way. To take this to the next step, I'm going to ask my compadre Paul Holdengraber to come up here and lead the panel about where we can go from here.
All my panelists to come up, and I will place them. And then I will hopefully instigate this conversation. So, We have Michael Moore sitting here, who will be the translator for Khaled, who will be sitting there. Next to him will be Imam Sajid. Jocelyn Cesari will be right next to the Imam. Bas Heine will be there. Benjamin Barber, who's right behind me, will be next to me. So any reactions to that conversation that you saw illustrated that between Errol Morris and Philip Gurevich? I'm just curious if we can bring that up.
I think these sketches were very, very not only provocative and informative, but also factual. It gives me an impression that Abu Ghraib made it possible to understand what domination can do and how people can be hurt and insulted. And that provoked the debates throughout the world. And that's what Linda England was, of course, prosecuted, and fate, whatever the fate it had. But it also made the point that how individual can do to the other individuals, where what we are talking about earlier, where mutual respect has gone, and that also reflects us that we should be thinking very seriously on these issues.
There is a literature of terrorism that encompasses almost everything that's been written that says if you're looking for a single word to explain the hatred, resentment, and murderous intent of terrorists, the word humiliation is the one you have to look for. Humiliation is what causes people to go off. This isn't a way to excuse terrorism, but a way to explain it. And I think Abu Ghraib came to misdefine, actually, the war because, and the United States, because the United States was seen, in terms of Abu Ghraib, exclusively in terms of humiliation. There's never been a better portrait of humiliation, and in a way the comic rendering of it in this film were remarkable, because by making it into a kind of comic piece, it made it even more horrendous, the poignancy right. of that humiliation. But I think it points to the centrality of humiliation in the dialectic between those who become terrorists and those who see themselves, namely us, as victims of terrorism, but in fact are complicit in one way or another, often in forms of humiliation that we don't even see. These are obvious, and here the humiliation was obvious, but there are other subtler forms of humiliation that are also at stake. But the word that jumps out from this, jumps out from Abu Ghraib, jumps out from perhaps 8 years of a policy, which, whether you agree with it or not, that term humiliation is, I think, core and says a lot.
Any other thoughts? Before I jump into the subject at hand, which may have something to do with humiliation, may have something to do with terrorism.
One of the authors ended the conversation by saying that, you know, perhaps humiliation was the purpose of one of the main purpose of the invasion, more than the other reasons given. And he didn't, and said, well, what would that mean? And then he didn't answer. Perhaps he did answer in the real conversation. But I think that's a very interesting point to make, and I think it's when we talk about humiliation, we just heard in the perception, the images in the last conversation. I think, in a way, many also the Americans felt humiliated in a way. So there is a kind of deep resentment, a sense of humiliation that's almost active everywhere, and we talk about Europe, and that it's not only the sense of it's one of the hidden emotions behind all discussions about freedom, liberty, threats of identity. So I think that's a very important point that he made, that this need to humiliate is much stronger than people care to admit.
Well, you know, I was very pleased, Bas, that Zeba had the courage for the first time. I don't know why it took so much courage, but actually to mention the subtitle of these proceedings. We gave it the subtitle of Insult, Colon, Fractured States. Now, the word terrorism, when it came up with Paul Berman yesterday, everybody shuddered and didn't want to really go there quite as much as we have already now. The word insult stayed nobody mentioned the subtitle, and I was wondering why. Before, Jocelyn, yeah. you come up with maybe a theory why we avert it. Maybe not the theory, but say something perhaps both about the movies and about the word insult. Do you know the origin of the word insult? It's quite interesting. I looked it up by formation or deformation, by my inclination, my gait, my training. I thought to myself, you know, we need to look up what the word insult is. And the word insult comes from insultare, to leap upon, scoff, from salire, to be salient, pointing outward, prominent. So the question for me really is, who feels insulted? Who is insulting? But you might have something to say about that.
Yeah, I thought it was a very good way to capture the situation in Europe today, insult and fractures, because we can say that Muslims feel insulted, and we have in mind the last episode, which is the Danish cartoons and what it, I mean, how it became global and so on. But doing all these surveys across Europe, what we see also a lot is non-Muslims feeling insulted or threatened by some lifestyle from Muslims. So we have to take really into account these two mutual sense of insult and fragility and threat to what is the ontological self. And when I talk to a lot of European young people who are not Muslims, they feel threatened, and someone said it in the previous panel, by Muslims that may look more solid in the way they can act or behave in the name of their faith or norms. And I think this is seen as a threat. On the other way around, Muslims feel, and with right and good reasons, insulted by the way they can be treated when they express this faith. And I think we really have here, if we want to have a real picture of the situation of Islam in Europe, to look at both. We cannot just treat one part of the equation and ignore the others. And unfortunately, that's not what's happening. In research, it's not what's happening in political discourse, it's not even what's happening in the media. We're talking a lot about media, but usually we tend to give favor to one point of view or the other, but there is a need to overcome the fracture today and to be more inclusive, to bring these two fair together, not discard one over the other.
I know that Imam Sajid is dying to say something, but quickly, do you believe then that having a firm identity is a threat? Did I understand you well?
No, being perceived as, I mean, we are all here, all the situation are related to perception and projection. And Islam is described, and I will maybe insist a little more about that later, is really seen as a sort of block, a monolithic entity that builds someone, like, you know, building block, like a Lego kind of thing. So, and this can be seen as dangerous, and I have heard a lot of people belonging, we're talking with my colleague about the Netherlands. You go to the Netherlands, sexual minorities, gays, they feel threatened maybe by a Muslim neighbor. It's wrong. It doesn't have any ground, but they feel also this threat. So this is the kind of thing that you have to take into account in the crisis around Islam today. So insult and fracture, yes, Muslims are insulted. Muslims may be, and Islam may be ghettoized, and I want to make a difference here. We should not consider equal Islam and Muslims. I think there is an Islamic issue. Muslims are not an issue, and I can explain that. But you have also the other part, and it shows in the last results of the European elections. This is a sign of also a sense of threat and fear.
Well, I will say that for Muslims' point of view, Muslims need to recognize their own wrongs as well. I also begin in the recent history. It was Iranian Revolution when they have made what we call it ambassadors of a country, of this country, hostages, so US was hurt and insulted. When Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, then the Muslim world became insulted and fractured altogether because infidels have been invading a Muslim country predominantly, a poor country on earth and that way. And when Salman Rushdie wrote Satanic Verses, it insulted the whole Muslim world by writing a fiction, but making the point that how Muslims could be insulted.
Did it insult you?
It insulted me very much. I had a debate with him 3 times, radio and TV, and also face to face in a place like this, and openly before February 1989.
But you had actually
to Haydn.
You actually had read it.
I read it unlike before even printed.
Unlike some people who were insulted without reading it.
Cover to cover. Yeah. I was actually one of the 5 persons who were given the advance copy to read and give my reaction. And I gave a written reaction to Penguins that it should not be published, including Khushwat Singh from India, who said it should not be published because not only it will humiliate Muslims, but Muslim will be uproared and it will be insulting. Well, because book itself, it would have been written without what we call it accuracy of the story and putting other way around, God and devil, other way around, then would have been different. But he meant it to insult the way, especially the wives of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and in Medina. So that type of issue was very much insultive to all of us because it's a second article of faith that no one can insult Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and that's really central. But what I'm saying, that Danish cartoon has been mentioned, don't want to repeat. Pope Benedict have mentioned Islam is evil and spread by sword, those type of a historian statement of 15th century, 11th century could not be repeated in this type of age and situation, which can be unnoticed. Anti-Semitism is insultive to not only my Jewish colleagues, but to Muslims as well, because we are Semitic in one way. And Islamophobia is insultive to the Muslims because it's a degradation and a discrimination and it's a hate. I say always that hate is a plague of Europe. Unless we all get together and cure it, this become an institution. Previous century, Jews suffered, not because of their color was different, not because of their any other things were different, other than that their language was Yiddish and they eat what we call it kosher food. Muslims are suffering today, as Josephine has mentioned it, because of the exactly same nature. We need to address these fractured states in which we're living so that we should have a mutual respect and understanding of each other and work together to address this issue of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, because where there is anti-Semitism, Islamophobia is not far away. And where there is Islamophobia, anti-Semitism is not far away.
Khaled Fouad Alam, hatred is the plague of Europe.
L'insulto è il prodotto di un conflitto.
An insult is a product of a conflict.
È vero che c'è una simmetria nelle forme dell'insulto sia da parte dei musulmani che da parte dell'Occidente.
It's true that there's a symmetry in the forms of the insults, both by the Islamic side and the Western side.
Les chercheurs qui analysent les sites internet des fondamentalistes musulmans connaissent très bien le langage très violent et très insultant de ces sites internet.
I do want to say that it's wonderful that we're going from Italian to French, and I'm just wondering what. No, I know. This is not a fractured state. It is marvelous. I think it's quite wonderful. I mean, I like this, and next it will be Dutch. Maybe. No. I was hoping. I mean, you know, and maybe.
But researchers who study the internet are very aware of the reciprocal nature of these.
Però credo che la dimensione dell'insulto nella relazione Occidente-Islam lavora su una categoria che è molto diversa.
but I do believe that the type of insult, the category of insult of the West toward Islam operates on a different level.
Io stesso ho ricevuto delle minacce e degli insulti perché sono stato un deputato al Parlamento italiano e perché scrivo anche su Repubblica e altri giornali.
I have, myself have been subject to threats and to insults because I was a member of the Italian Parliament and because I write for the newspaper La Repubblica.
Ma nella grande questione della relazione Islamo-Occidente, in relazione all'insulto, c'è l'enorme problema del rapporto fra storia e memoria.
But I think that the very big question in the relationship between Islam in the West is the question of the historical question of the relationship between history and memory.
L'Islam non è storia, ma non è memoria condivisa.
Islam has history, but it does not have a shared memory.
È da lì che nascono gli enormi problemi culturali che diventano oggi dei problemi politici.
Hence arise the enormous cultural problems that today become political problems.
Superare l'insulto significa uscire dal divorzio fra storia e memoria nell'Islam e nell'Occidente.
And overcoming insult means overcoming the divorce between history and memory that is in the West.
Però il contesto attuale è molto frammentato.
Today's situation is very fragmented.
Perché in realtà quello che si sta sviluppando in Europa e che favorirà sempre di più gli insulti è quello che io chiamo la nascita di frontiere simboliche.
Because of what's happening in Europe, which is fomenting more and more insults, which I consider the birth of la nascita di...
Huh?
La nascita di...
Di frontiere simboliche.
The birth of symbolic borders.
E questo spiega attualmente la crescita, abbiamo visto alle elezioni europee, dei partiti di estrema destra o populisti.
And this explains the growth, as we've seen in the recent European elections, of extremist and nationalist parties.
Dunque l'insulto è presente sia all'interno dell'Islam sia nella relazione Islam-Occidente.
So the insult is present both within Islam but also in the relationship between the West and Islam.
Ma le categorie sono diverse sul quale l'insulto lavora.
But the categories within which insults operate are different.
Anche perché all'interno dell'Islam c'è una crisi dell'Islam contemporaneo.
Also because within Islam there is a contemporary crisis.
La questione della democrazia, della libertà, eccetera.
The question of democracy, of freedom, etc.
Dei diritti individuali, eccetera.
And of individual rights.
Questo provoca l'insulto all'interno dell'Islam.
Which provokes a kind of insult within Islam.
Dunque molti scrittori, e non solo, musulmani sono insultati dagli stessi musulmani.
So many writers, not just writers, are insulted by Muslims themselves.
Ma la cosa più complicata è la relazione fra Islam e Occidente, Islam e Europa.
But what is more complicated is the relationship between Islam and the West, Islam and Europe.
Perché siamo nel profondo di ciò che sono i rapporti culturali.
Because we are in the very depth of what cultural relations are.
E uscirne non è facile.
And it's very hard to come out of them.
Thank you.
I'm curious by this notion of no shared memory. I'm not 100% sure I completely understood why you mentioned that, because to me, going back to a discipline I know a little bit more about, I know very little about what we're talking about today, I'm going to try to do my best with all of your communal knowledge, but there was a time, not so long ago, in the 19th century in particular, where great writers, I'm thinking particularly of the German Romantics, of the French, whether it was in the 17th century with Montesquieu and Voltaire, in the 18th century, and then in the 19th century, the Romantics, had a real sense of speaking of the Orient, as it were. Even though the Orient was kept away, they somehow entered the consciousness. Now we have the immigrants living within the borders of Europe, and it seems that they have pushed away the understanding of that consciousness. So I'm wondering what has happened, where has that shift, what has provoked that shift, as it were?
If I may pick up on that, I would be a little more harsh with this literature. It's a wonderful literature. I grew up on it, and I loved it.
You would be a little more harsh with the romantic literature,
yes,
of Nerval.
Yes, because it's, again, what are we talking about? We are talking about a series of, a topos, which is an imaginary place where you put Islam and Muslims, but they don't reflect the reality. This doesn't reflect the reality of people. It's part of the imaginary of the West, and we know very well through historians that, for example, Western Europe has built itself in this relationship competition with the Muslim world in the Mediterranean area. The modernity of Europe came from confronting the Ottoman Empire, and we know all that through the different episodes of that. And what it means that all the terms that we are proud of, like democracy, equality, progress, have been built against, in the mirror, with the image of the Ottoman Empire. I'm going to give you just a few examples. The term fanaticism that we use so much today, the first occurrence of it, 1688, associated with the Prophet Muhammad. It doesn't come with the Rushdie affair. It doesn't come with the cartoons crisis. Voltaire, I'm sorry, I'm going to turn to French because it's the original title. Le prophète Mohammed ou l'esprit du fanatisme. Yeah. 1688. Okay.
The prophète Mohammed or the spirit of fanaticism. Sorry.
This is 1688, despotism. Today, this is the term you use to describe the necessity of democratizing the Middle East, right? The term despotism was created by Montesquieu, looking at the Ottoman Empire and building this sense of European politics and modernity of politics. You look at what the Ottoman Empire was at the time. It was such a sophisticated political system. You can use any term you want, but the term despotism for sure didn't restitute that. So what I'm trying to say here, okay for the literature, but not thinking that this literature did the real job of opening up the reality of men and women of flesh and blood in this society. It didn't, and it's okay. It's part of also building ourselves as Westerners. But the typical other of the West has always been the Muslim. So there is no real surprise today in seeing this building and projection amplified at the international level for reasons also concrete that you can find in the political situation in Muslim societies. But what I'm saying is that there is a repertoire here that you can trace back much, much later in all in other
earlier
periods.
These books were existed in 1888, but if you go even earlier, even the first century of Islam, John Al-Kindi from Damascus wrote horrible books about Muhammad, peace be upon him. But these books were seen as academic in terms of understanding the other and fear of the other. It was read by scholars and the readers, not by commoner approached the way it has been done it. Fact is this, that we are dealing with today, this has come up on the recent events in terms of making it much more publicly aware that how insult can do to the others.
What harm it can do, you mean.
What harm can be done.
You know, it's kind of discouraging, I must say. We started a couple of days ago with the clash of civilizations and Europe and the other and Muslims as immigrants. And I thought over the last several days we'd explored the actual realities of Muslims as Europeans,
yes,
in many cases for generations. We talked earlier this evening about Muslims in America as African Americans who have been here, you know, for many, many hundreds of years. And now we're sort of back to this, I would call it the tyranny of memory, you know, going back to a time when, you're quite right, the typical other, you know, was the Muslim. But I thought we've just spent time problematizing that. And I would love to see our debate now about humiliation and insult in the context of the fact that about a third of the Muslims in Germany and perhaps half in Holland are actually citizens of those countries,
right,
and are Dutch and are German and are French. They are not Muslim. They are Muslim Frenchmen, or they are Muslim.
You were talking about Ramadan.
And, you know, I think we need to go forward and not back. And if memory becomes a tyranny that forces us back into those things, then I think it's a problem. Because to me, the issue here, and the cartoons are a perfect example of it, the issue that's missing on the table, and maybe I see that because I'm a political scientist.
And because you're American and bold and brash.
Well, that too,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
By the way, it was okay when I said it. I'm not sure you should say it, though.
I've heard you say it, and I think that's very good. I just didn't want you to forget to be there.
The issue missing here is also power.
Yes, right.
The issue of power. I mean, offense, we all take offense at all sorts of things. You know, but the question is there power behind the offense? Mm-hmm. There is no parity between the words, excuse my descriptive use of them, nigger and honky. Because when a white man says nigger, there is a history of lynching, inequality, and slavery right in the background, and the threat of a lynching is always there even today. When a black man says honky, he's spitting into the wind. I mean, so what? I mean, what did George Bush calls if he cares if he's called a honky? The cartoons in Copenhagen, to me, were a mistake and had nothing to do with civil liberty because a small minority of Muslims with no power were being humiliated in the name of free expression by a large white majority. I say to those cartoonists, go to Riyadh and publish your cartoons. That's fine. Then that's civil liberties. That's speaking up. And see, you might get your head cut off, but that's what happens sometimes when you do that. But don't do it in Copenhagen where you're speaking for an oppressive majority and humiliating people with no power. So the power issue, to me, is absolutely crucial and has to be factored into it. The founders of America said the freedom of expression is an instrument of democracy, an instrument of empowerment. It's not just there to say things for the right to offend people. You can offend people when you do it on the way to trying to balance power, to take on and empower yourself. That has not been true in Europe. In Europe, there is no parity between those who insult Muslims and those who are, say, insulted by Muslims or by things that Muslims say and do. And that, the power issue, is the one that hasn't been on the table.
Yes, but I'm afraid it's even more complicated because what you say is absolutely right, Benjamin, but the perception is by a large and growing group of people who voted massively for the extreme right party at the European elections last week, for a man who wants to forbid the Quran, is that they see themselves as victims. And you can say to them, well, that's nonsense, you're the one with the power, but they see themselves as overwhelmed.
How do you interpret this
election? Well, I think the problem is, and that's why these conversations are so difficult, is that in Holland, at least, but I think in more countries in Western Europe, the whole aversion to Islam or Muslims or immigrants, you could say, is part of a much larger problem. It has to do with globalization. The aversion against Europe nowadays, the Union, is as strong as the aversion against Muslims. So it's part of the fear of globalization, of something being lost, or you have to give away something and you get nothing back. That's, I think, the rationale, if you could call it rational, behind this emotion, is as strong as with Europe. You give something away, you don't get anything back. With Islam, Holland is not Holland anymore. That's the slogan. And even people, they're not only the uneducated people. There are more and more people are saying that. And I think Holland is a somewhat special case, but I think it's typical for the rest of Western Europe, is that because of this liberal reputation for tolerance, you know, Holland, I don't have to explain that, I think, to this audience, Holland wasn't very traditional. And now these people say, you know, not only our freedoms are threatened, but also our identity. And in the last panel, I heard someone say, you know, identity is not essentialist, you know, and, you know, it's dynamic. Identities change all the times. But these people would say, you know, we've heard that during the heydays of multiculturalism, we all know that, but we want our identities not to be dynamic. We want it to be firm. And also, with some Muslims, the same emotion applies. They feel the same emotion. They say that we don't want to be dynamical. We want to be firm, and we want to know who we are. And I think from every attempt from above to say, you know, we're in a pluralistic world and we all have multiple identities, we should celebrate diversity, is somehow catastrophic because it comes from above. And people say, you know, we've heard that all before. And now it's our turn. And as much as I regret it in Holland, it's very difficult to answer this because, you know, they've heard all the arguments before, but they don't longer apply. So that is a quite... Well, I think it's heading for a collision. I mean, much positive signs.
La memoria non è un concetto. La memoria ha da fare con il riconoscimento, con l'esistenza.
Memory is not a concept. It has to do with recognition, with existence.
È una questione politica.
And it's a political question.
Guardate che quelli che rifiutano adesso l'entrata della Turchia in Europa si basano proprio sulla questione della memoria.
For example, those who are rejecting the entrance of Turkey into the European Union base their arguments on memory.
La Turchia non deve entrare in Europa perché non fa parte della memoria europea occidentale.
They say that Turkey shouldn't become a part of the European Union because it does not belong to the Western European memory.
È un altro mondo, è l'Oriente.
It's another world, it's the Orient.
Il mitico Oriente.
The mythical Orient.
You just came back from Turkey, no? Did you encounter this?
No.
You did not?
I actually did not. I want to embrace what you said. Yes. I want to join the issue. It is true.
We'll get back, don't worry.
Let's come back, but this is really important because the fact is, I think white populists on the right are, in a sense, also victims. There's no question they're victims of modernity, they're victims of globalization, they're victims of multiculturalism as well. They see their monocultures, which they associate with a memory of who they are and where they come from, going down the drain. They see a Europe constituted not by citizenship, but by big corporations and run by those corporations that leaves them out. And there's nothing more terrible than the war of the weak. Mm. You know, the war of disempowered Muslims against the disempowered working right. In the United States, poor white Southern workers out of a job, they blame Mexicans, they blame blacks. You know, the guy who just killed somebody, you know, down in Washington is a desperate man, and certainly he's part of a group of disempowered, not empowered Americans. He's not part.
He's been desperate for a long time.
That's right. So it's right to say that it's, you know, desperation and disempowerment is not just a feature of, say, Muslim minorities. It's also a feature of traditional groups that were once quite powerful that aren't powerful anymore and see themselves. So the question is, how do we mediate that so that the weak don't turn on each other and devour each other, while the people who are inheriting the world, the big corporations, big business, globalization, and eats them both? That becomes the political question. Right now, they feed on one another. Right-wing populists turn on the minorities. The minorities see the right-wing working class as their enemies, and that, of course, suits the elites very well.
And before bringing in Jocelyn, how is it that you saw exactly the opposite in Turkey?
Well, because what happened in Turkey there's not time to do it properly, but Turkey has spent 60 years in the hands of the Kemalist nationalists who rejected Islam, who rejected the Ottoman Empire, created a government around secularism and around keeping Islam out. And then 10 years ago, 15 years ago, Muslims began to say, we want to be represented, particularly Muslims from outside the Istanbul area. They created their own party, the AKP. The AKP won party, won power, and for a while, the Turkish nationalists, the Turkish Kemalists, the Turkish secularists said, this is the end of us. Now we're going to have this Islamicist revolution. They're going to take over. They're going to destroy our secular society, everything we Kemalists have been trying to achieve. But instead, it turned out that these Muslims, quite moderate but wanting political party, were simply another political party. And the recent elections actually reduced their power somewhat, 7 or 8 points. So it turned out they could also be defeated electorally. The army stayed out, thank God. The army has been the sort of nationalist constitution keeper. When it sees something happen that gets in the way of Kemalism, it's always intervened. It didn't this time, and thank God it didn't. But the result is Turkey represents, I think, an extraordinary place for hope for a moderate integration of secularism and Islam.
Ben is going to keep the dial of hope up, which I think is good, since after all, we do want to get beyond the fracture. Jocelyn.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to this fractured Europe, and just to...
I want to get beyond it soon, but go ahead.
To present how you go beyond the fracture. What we have done, when I say we, is because the Islam in the West program that I coordinate put together initiative across Europe and America as well to provide information and knowledge that can be used in a different way to communicate. And if you want to see that, you can go to the Euro-Islam website, where we put up there these different resources that can be used to communicate by politicians, journalists. We are talking about media. This site is very much used by journalists, by the way. So what we do there is to tell people you have to unpack things that are put together all the time when it comes about Islam in Europe, and it has been done during these 3 days, actually, no critique intended, in the sense that...
Please, I welcome
that,
it.
We say all the time in the communication, we have to insist on the non-exceptionalism of Islam and Muslims. This is very important. The Islam is not an exceptional religion, and Muslims are not exceptional human beings in no way. So what does it mean? It means that we put together immigration, socioeconomic problem, ethnicity, and international constraints all together packed. And under this term, you have, under this three dimension, built what we call the Islam in Europe issue, you know. And I just want to unpack that, because this is very important to do. And I will. Why? Because in Europe, unlike America, and I live in this country, and it's very important to make the transatlantic comparison, most of immigrants are Muslims. So when Europeans talk a lot about immigration, they have all Islam in mind, while Islam is not the issue. The issue is the issue that is also discussed in America, but not with Muslims in mind, with Mexicans in mind. And this is something important to do, to unpack that. Why I am insisting on that? Because in a country like the Netherlands, it's also discussed in Germany, it's also discussed in France now. Because of this obsession of Islam, what politicians are doing is issuing new laws of immigration that ask the newcomers to fit into the liberal core values. Usually you immigrate and you adapt, right, to the core values of the country in which you come in. Now they are tested before on issues like tolerance for homosexuality, tolerance for sexual promiscuity, and things. What does it mean? It means that a newcomer in the Netherlands will have to see pictures of naked people on the beach or homosexuals kissing and test its capacity to accept this or not. This is because Europeans think that all immigrants are Muslims, and then they have to be put aside in case they come in too big numbers to change the balance of these values. So this is one important thing. We have to disentangle Islam and immigration. Second, we have also to disentangle the question of Islam and socioeconomic poverty. If you go across Europe, you talk about les banlieues in France, the ghetto here and there, everybody thinks that Islam is the reason of the disenfranchisement.
So I see both Imam Sajid and Bas Hainye going like that, or you...
Can I finish?
Yeah, of course you can, please.
Because this is also an important point. What we have seen in the... Because we are talking in this program to Muslims of flesh and blood all over, and young people of Muslim background are saying, we are victimized because of Islam. This is not true. They have also, the young people, to overcome this particular discourse. And one of the reasons we are interacting in all these places is to tell them, you can take advantage of this situation as well and not put Islam as a label on your front and on your forehead. And this is something that is built, again, in this mutual interaction that doesn't make the difference between an immigrant and Islam or Muslim, between someone with socioeconomic problem and someone who is a Muslim. And this has been built over 10, I come from France a few years ago, 20 years in the case of France. How can you explain that in some banlieue in France today, someone with fourth generation of Algerian background can still be considered an immigré maghrébin, a migrant from North Africa? When he speaks French, he dreams in French, he dresses French, he doesn't speak Arabic, there is something bizarre. And he will define, or she will define herself as a Maghrebin. So this is the point here. And the third point is about ethnicity and culture. We have really to address the question of Islam as a religion. And all Europeans today are dancing around the fire. They are not addressing it. In the Netherlands, the question is, how can we accommodate multicultural differences when the multiculturalism lead to tolerance toward beating wives or toward showing abuse of... This is cultural behavior. This is not Islam. And nobody is listening to some clerics, especially in the UK, who are saying beating your wife is not part of Islam. It's patriarchal attitude. It's about time to make the difference.
I think
this is also an important... We don't listen to Muslims.
So exactly. I was just about to say, let's listen to the imam, if you
will. While
yeah.
we agree that we should not be prisoners of a past, we must learn lessons of our mistakes and the past
if we're
and move
wise.
On.
If we're wise, we do.
And if we take a Holland example, just an example, because I'm a regular visitor to Netherlands and have been advisor to there a number of institutions, including police and others. They were the most liberal, democratic, secular society in the whole European country until they brought the people from Suriname on the limited visa called guest worker, for a limited period, for 2 to 3 years, never actually took seriously that these people will marry and will they have a children and will they have the schools and the mosque, and never planned about anything else. When the population grew of the second and third generation, they start panicking that we cannot enter into their areas, there's no gay area. And here I come in Utrecht, going there and seeing those communities where Dutch police cannot even enter. I say, why you think that way? Why not you hire these Algerian and North African people and make them as an interpreter so that you can get in go between and go and visit Morocco and live 6 months there, learn their terminologies of the language and the culture and see how they perform. And 6 years later, I go in the same town. And there's no-go area. Half of the police officers have been employed by that area, and I have to take 6 police officers from England to show them the model that while problem you're facing here, racism in UK, go and learn from Dutch what to do it. Problem with them happened, they never planned 20, 30, 40 years ahead that how community will look like. Deep-rooted issue, I said, in hate, is linked with racism because of the issue of race equality laws in UK, for example, and multiculturalism we were talking about. There was color racism was very known in US, but the cultural racism was known in Europe. Cultural racism based upon the way we live and the way we approach. I totally agree that immigration and related matters, and especially social cultural circumstances, lack of jobs and others, created a fear. But that was not the real fear. Fear was exactly what Benjamin said it about power, and they are coming. If they are coming, where we will go? Because they are the people who are more religious. More people pray on Fridays than all Europe together for the whole year. For the whole year. That is the fact which has come up by many, many sources again and again. That makes them to fear. Because somebody told me, when you, after the prayer, say Bismillah, Alhamdulillah, Allahu Akbar, these your tasbih, those your meditation, actually you frighten us all because it means you are preparing for something. This is the issue which goes back to ignorance, which earlier we were talking about. Because a lot of these things are misunderstood because of the not understanding academically what the issues are. Issues when we're talking about segregation, radicalization, youth alienation, that's again captured because the generation gap. Some Muslims, stupidly, do not really live in the country where they're living. They're still living in somewhere else. And that causes the problem. And that happened in Holland, that happened in England, that happened in Germany, that happened in France. So we need to understand social cultural issues with economic difficulties.
So I wonder how we do that. I wonder if integration is the goal. I wonder if the characterization that Jocelyn gave of Holland and of people coming there and having to see these images and react to them is accurate.
Well, the way she said it is that they are it looked like they were forced to watch a kind of porn movie. I think there's one picture of a naked breasts, I think, only. But
only.
But there is. But I think
only.
She's
we heard that only.
She's
yeah.
absolutely well. That's yeah. very normal in Holland to show your breasts. But I mean, but and that's why everybody feels threatened now because lots of people don't feel no. No, but I think there's a reaction going on in Holland,
yes.
And it's also a reaction. It's also a crisis of self-image. Mm. I think Dutch society for a long time knew where it was going, or thought it was knew where it was going. It was strong believers in Europe, strong believers in multiculturalism,
yes.
And strong believers in liberalism, in personal freedom. I think with this, I think everybody knows Holland for personal freedom. You can have gay marriage, euthanasia. I mean, drugs are were tolerated, not hard drugs, that you always have to say that. But for a long time, everybody looked at, well, they, you know, there's not a lot of debate about these personal issues, but they're all about personal freedom. They're not about community, about what makes a country work. And I think now all these questions that
resurface,
and the Dutch, generally speaking, feel, well, we have nothing left to fall back upon. So that's, I think, is one of the why the reaction in Holland.
And they revert, having nothing to fall back on, they revert to certain.
They invent or reinvent, but I think they reinvent nationalism, they reinvent a kind of personal identity or national identity. There's a lot of debate, I won't bore you with it, about a new museum that has to be built about national history, because nobody cared about national history in Holland for a long time, and suddenly it's all, the debate is all over that. So that's all part, it's not only about Muslims, and rightly, it's about, you know, we don't know who we are. And perhaps, I think a lot of Dutch Muslims don't know who they are. I mean, they feel lost in a sense. I know a lot of Moroccan Dutch youth who are very doubt. They have problems at home with the generation gap. There is a generation gap. They have lots of trouble with their fathers, sons mostly, also girls. So they feel a bit, you know, they don't know where to look at. So they have, and some of them, they fall back on Islamism, on strong identity. So that's happening. They're very Dutch in that sense. But everybody feels insulted. Everybody feels humiliated. Everybody feels lost in a way. So
So I wonder the very Dutchness that, yes, I'll get to you in a second, the very Dutchness that you're describing, might it find a solution looking now abroad towards America and towards a certain multicultural model, which I know is dear to Benjamin Barber. And so I'm wondering, you know, in some way the inspiration, and I want to get obviously to the Cairo speech of Obama, the inspiration that the Europeans now are feeling coming out of America, having recently been in Lyon, France, it was amazing and tremendous to me to feel the French envious of America.
Yes.
I mean, it's something I have never experienced before.
Yes.
I mean, all of a sudden, I mean, at least in my life, I have never felt such such admiration love and l'Amérique. I mean, it was said
yes.
with a huge smile.
Usually, that's called manic depressive. I mean.
Yeah.
And some critics of America said,
drugs,
you know,
yeah.
to go from this way to that way in such a short time is a sign of manic depressiveness. So I don't know it's very unsure what will happen here also, I think. But I think you're absolutely right, that usually Holland follows, they love America, and not only culturally, but also, so for the last 8 years, there was a wave of neoconservatism also in Holland. And you would expect now that there were signs that because Obama is much loved in Holland, but there, I mean, Dutch society now more resembles where we talked about Denmark in the last section, or Austria. They feel very small, closed in, claustrophobic, and that's that's been going on for 8 years, and that's not well. The mayor of Rotterdam is a Muslim,
Moroccan, yes.
And that's of course quite unusual in the rest of Europe. But then mayors are not elected in Holland, so it's from the top down. And 22% of Rotterdam of the people of Rotterdam voted for the extreme right party at the European election. Yeah. So that's the paradox that needs to.
C'è comunque un problema generale in Europa.
There is a general problem in Europe.
E che noi non sappiamo trattare politicamente la questione della diversità culturale.
That we don't know how to politically address the problem of cultural diversity.
La diversità culturale ha bisogno di un trattamento politico.
Cultural diversity has to be dealt with politically.
E perciò è evidente che oggi c'è un conflitto fra diversità culturale e democrazia.
So obviously there's a problem between cultural diversity and democracy.
Ma la diversità culturale non vuol dire unicamente l'Islam.
But cultural diversity doesn't only mean Islam.
Io ho studiato bene la questione delle banlieue in Francia e la questione delle banlieue non aveva niente da fare con l'Islam, aveva da fare con le questioni di diritti riconosciuti, sociale, del lavoro, dell'economia, eccetera.
I studied very closely the eruptions in the banlieue in France, and it had absolutely nothing to do with Islam. It had everything to do with rights to work, with social protection.
E si vive attualmente in Europa una specie di schizofrenia.
In Europe right now we're living a kind of schizophrenia.
Da una parte è presente una forte eterogeneità delle culture.
On the one hand you have a strong heterogeneity of cultures.
Ma non sappiamo tradurre, inventare un linguaggio politico di questa diversità culturale.
But we do not know how to invent a political language for that cultural diversity.
E questo rende tutto complicato la situazione attuale.
Which makes the current situation very complicated.
Fa crescere in modo esponenziale i populismi.
And leads to an exponential growth in populism.
Però vorrei ricordare che il populismo è la porta aperta alla violenza politica.
But I would like to remind everyone that populism is an open door to violence, to political violence.
Io abito a Trieste, a 2 chilometri dalla ex Yugoslavia.
I live in Trieste, 2 kilometers away from the former Yugoslavia.
E posso vedere ancora oggi i disastri dei conflitti culturali.
And I can still witness today the disasters of the cultural conflicts there.
Nella città di Mostar.
In the city of Mostar.
Alla scuola elementare.
At the elementary school.
I bambini musulmani entrano da una parte.
The Muslim children enter in one door.
I bambini cattolici da un'altra parte.
And the Catholic children enter through another door.
Ecco, questo è qualcosa ovviamente che va assolutamente evitata se vogliamo evitare il disastro.
And this is something that we obviously have to avoid if we want to avoid the disaster.
So,
e per questo credo che la speranza è fondamentale anche in politica.
This is why I think that hope is fundamental also in the reign of politics.
Ma ci sono dei nodi storici anche che non possiamo occultare qui.
But there are historical precedents that we should not hide.
Fra gli Stati Uniti e l'Europa.
Between the United States and Europe, for example.
La genesi della nazione in Europa è stata basata.
The genesis of the nation in Europe.
Su un rapporto stretto fra l'identità del sé e l'identità religiosa e culturale.
Was based on the close relationship between self-identity and religious identity.
Mentre la nazione americana è stata basata sulla diversità culturale.
Where the American nation was based on cultural diversity.
Quello che manca in Europa è una specie di patriottismo costituzionale.
What we don't have in Europe is a kind of constitutional patriarchism.
Ma attualmente non può esistere perché non esiste una Costituzione europea.
But it can't exist because there is no European constitution.
E allora il ripiegamento della nazione diventa un ripiegamento comunitario.
So when a nation sort of falls back on itself, the whole European Union falls back on itself.
E questo è molto pericoloso.
Which is very dangerous.
Ben,
coming right off of Fuad's comments, which are I think exactly to the point, and coming back to your concern with the populist right, let me. For a couple of days we've been talking about the other side. I want to defend populism. I want to defend right-wing populism, even. Or
defend
at least
it.
Defend it, or at least explain it, in ways that is a kind of defense. Right-wing populism is the politics of the disempowered. In this case, they happen to be the formerly powerful, the nationalists, the people who ran the state. But they are now, in their own way, economically, deeply disempowered. the Socialist Party, every one of its leaders supported the European Constitution, which was a 480-page legal document that no one but lawyers could read, that was advanced in the name of democracy but had little to do, in fact, with democracy. 70% of the Socialist Party membership voted against the Constitution. They didn't see it as an instrument of democratization. They saw it as a further instrument of their own de-democratization, as part of the democratic deficit. And by the way, I think they were right and their leaders were wrong, the way that Constitution, in fact, had been written and what its intentions were. Right before Martin Luther King was killed, he made an extraordinary statement. You might remember he had this, I think it was called Operation Breadbasket, which was organized around food and economic equality. And he said, if poor blacks and the poor whites who despise them ever understood what they had in common, how much they shared, we would have a real American Revolution. Martin Luther King was in effect defending, in a certain way, the very poor whites who were the core of American racists. But their racism was a unfortunate and unhealthy and irrational reaction to their powerlessness. And of course, those who did well in America were delighted to see poor whites and poor blacks despise one another while they went on running the country and running the world. We have a rather similar situation today in Europe. Well, the elites who are running Europe are very pleased, I think, in their own way, to see immigrant Muslims attacked by right-wing populists and right-wing populists recognizing a democratic deficit, seeing themselves as disempowered because the war of the weak insulates the strong and allows them to move their globalizing agenda forward. Here's my question then. Is there a politics in Europe or America that can embrace both of those parties, and what does it look like? It won't be a cultural party for sure. It won't be a party based on religion. But if it's based on economics, if it's based on an appreciation and recognition of economic and political power, it's not impossible that such a thing will happen. Let me end with an anecdote. I worked with Clinton in the 90s, and there was the most amazing thing Clinton ever said was in a debate at Camp David, and it was right after the Democrats had been defeated overwhelmingly by the Newt Gingrich, you know, group that took over the House in 1994, and Hillary was, along with a bunch of other people, was saying to Bill Clinton, it's time you stop defending the poor whites of Arkansas and the poor whites of the South. You owe them nothing. They're the ones who robbed you of your power. They're the ones who Newt Gingrich won. And Bill Clinton said, until America reaches a point where we do not put the progress of blacks and Hispanics on the back of poor whites and make them pay the price of that progress, we will never have civil peace and we will never have a genuine progressive party. And that, to me, goes to the he didn't figure out quite how to do it, although interestingly he had the core support of the black community and he had the widespread support of poor southern whites, so-called crackers. And he found a way around his personality to bring them together. I'm not sure he discovered a politics that worked. We're now back again in a situation where white populists in America, unemployed union members, are seeing Mexican immigrants as their enemy and so on. But the immigrants in Europe and the immigrants in America are here because of the laws of economics, because the elite corporations need their labor and want it cheap and draw them here. And then, of course, that creates frictions with the internal population. That's happening in Europe the same way. So I don't have an answer, but I have a question. Is there a form of politics that allows the so-called dangerous populist right and the disempowered immigrant, Muslim, and other communities to find a common politics? If that happens, as Martin Luther King said, then we will have a genuine progressive
Let's
politics.
Let's try to answer that question. Well, it's a good challenge. Thank you very much.
It's a good question, but only in part because it's not only economics. It's not only the poor white. It's the middle class who has become revolutionary in Holland. So it's not only a question of poor against poor or disadvantaged against disadvantaged. That's part of the point. If you see the results of the election, Rotterdam, it's the people who are disadvantaged. But it's also, and I think it's much more of a question of identities than economics in the end. We talked about Turkey. The paradox is that Turkey is not part of the Western European memory, but most of the voters for this right-wing party go on holiday to Turkey every year. So they know it quite well. That's one of the paradoxes. They love it there. So that, but when the issue comes up, do you want Turkey to be part of Europe? Say no. So there are lots of paradoxes.
I want to go on vacation.
Yeah, yeah. No, but I think it's the abstract idea and reality. So there's a lot of, and I think you should make use of these paradoxes that are all over the place.
Answer to Ben's question lies in twofold. First of all, unless the new generation, European or American, are engaged in active politics and become part of the system as a participatory democracy, things will not change. Fact is this, why far-right parties won major cities in Europe? For two reasons. 70% of the citizens are not interested in voting today. Why? Because they think things will not change through ballot. And that is the fact in whole Europe. That's why far-right parties, minority parties, no one wants them, but they are. And then the main parties are disunited, and they're so their votes are cross purpose each other that the smaller far-right parties, individuals can win, including in London. You know, now Nick Griffin, one of the BNP fascist party leader, is going to sit in as an MEP in Europe who wanted to bulldoze Europe. That's what how the purpose of his party is. But coming to the point which earlier we were talking about, things have to change in religious leadership, in political leadership, in economic leadership. And we are in the crisis of economic crisis because of greed. Unless we go to the moral values and go to the basics, original thing, nothing is going to change in Europe, nothing to change in America. We will keep pouring money in, but then money has been sucked in a hole rather than giving any benefit to the wider community where our poor whites and poor blacks are not going to be uplifted from economic misery with their living. So we need to think for future. Future lies in partnership, in cooperation, in dialogue, in diplomacy, so, not jingoism, not power, not authority, not that we have a might and our might can change the world.
So
that's not going to happen.
So you are really taking us where we want to go, which is where do we go from here, which is the name of this discussion, this conclusion. I would like each one of you in closing, and then open it a little bit to the audience so that we don't keep them here all night. They've been here since 5 o'clock. I want to get a sense from you, where do we go from here? What are some of, if not the solutions, at least some of the opportunities that make us go beyond a fractured state?
Two sentences. First of all, we go back to our citizenship, rule of law, constitution, fundamental rights in Europe, as well as many other countries. At the moment, it is the minority power who is dominating the culture within the Europe. That has to change. We don't have a constitution, I totally agree, but we have laws, and laws are always good. You know, I'm not saying any single law in Europe is bad, except where there is a clear discrimination in employment and other places. There are a few pockets which need to be changed. OIC, Office of Security and Cooperation Europe, British Council and many, many other institutions, including EU and European commissions, are doing something good, but only on paper. I need actions. So where there is a mouth, there have to be some resources so that the people can choose. Education institution should teach anti-Semitism in classes. In all secondary school, this should be compulsory, because this is a plague of Europe, as I said earlier. Similarly, racism against Muslims, which is the sharp end of racism, have to be understood properly. Why? It may be economic reasons, but still it need to be understood so that next generation and generation after, we not face the problem which faced by last century.
Jocelyn.
There is a paradox in Europe that we have looked at the amount of money that has been put in politics of integration across Europe. It's huge. It's huge. I do not want this American audience to think that nothing has been done.
Very mixed audience, by the way. Okay. A lot of Europeans.
I mean, let's say this New Yorker audience.
Yes. Le Monde very well. And after Herod, so.
But Le Monde is not a good indicator of what I'm trying to say here. There has been huge amounts of euros and pounds put in the last 15 years in trying to integrate through education.
That's why I was wondering whether integration is a goal.
Yeah, and even, I mean, politically, it's true that nationally Muslims are not represented, but locally they are very much present. And Fouad is a good example, the mayor of Rotterdam is a good example. So Muslims are there. But at some point, what is now at the core issue is how do we put Islam in the public culture of all our countries? And this is not done. In the sense that, yes, we like Muslims when they partake in our values, but how much of the values of Islam are we ready to teach to the whole population, not only to Muslims? It's a problem. Please. It's a problem of education. Islam should not be two pages in the textbook when all the population are coming from the former colonies of all the European countries or historical ties, and it has to be part of the history. And Fouad is right, memory is not in the past. Memory is what your children are learning today in school. True. And Islam is not part of that. It's also part of political communication. And how do politicians communicate today about Islam is still part of this ghettoization and separation in Europe. And in this regard, indeed, Obama looks like a wonderful example, a counter-positive example of what should be done to be more inclusive. And this is not done. And this has nothing to do with Muslim X, Y, or Z trying to get into the system. It's a symbolic change that is related to communication and to changing the public culture. And we're talking about the example of African American. Each group in this country has really changed the public culture, be part of it. And this is what should be done for today in Muslims, not immigrants, but Muslims, because converts are encountering the same kind of issue sometimes.
Two points here, which Jocelyn has rightly said, that it's important that Muslims should be part of it. But Islam has been part of Europe for centuries. 700 years in Andalusia, in Spain, we showed a model of Jews, Christian, Muslim working together because it was dominated by Muslims. And Muslims always have integrated culturally and academically and also knowledge-wise to incorporate others. Muslims have always learned from others to do it. And it's not being done at the moment because they've been seen as a threat. I think we have to address and build trust and confidence. I always said to my prime ministers that you cannot impose something upon them. You have to build trust and confidence of your citizen so that they can become eye and ear against the evil of extremism and evil of terrorism.
Have they listened to you?
Well, sometime, not all the time. The reason is this, that they also have their own, what we call it, worries. That's what my fear about President Obama is, that he is inspirational. He is saying that we have to start a new beginning with the world of Islam and Muslims. Will somebody allow him to do it? Will there is a behind that action plan that what he wanted to do will do it? Will the settlement will stop today? And things like that, which he is asking for it, there is issues which will probably...
You mean settlement in Israel and Palestine?
Israel, yeah. Yes, because the West Bank, at the moment, there's thousands of settlements, illegal settlement, but nobody accepts that because it's occupied land. How are going to get that free to make a viable, sustainable Palestinian state? That is where the radicalization of Muslim youth in Europe is coming up. Not what it is, the foreign policy issues again. Abu Ghraib was a part of it. Dominance is part of it. Our jingoism, militarism is part of it. While there is a military is needed as a, what we call it, surgical operation, you need a parallel diplomacy in order to get the political debate going on for participation of the people. When we liberated Kuwait, why not we put a condition that there should be some sort of democratic institution build up for the local citizen? We never did that. And it's our mistakes as well. We must learn from our mistakes and do not repeat it for future.
Bas, you have a solution to all this.
Yes, I have. Now, I think one part of the solution is to be better to understand the paradoxes that are caught up with identity, self-esteem. And I think to make a compliment to the US, I think they have understood this better here, that you can be when you feel you have a sense of self or identity or cultural identity, you can use that to maneuver in a better way in a society that's plural. And I think that's one of the main, on the level of politics, on the level of a kind of, well, not grassroots, but on the basic of the people who are feel disenfranchised, they feel we can't be Dutch anymore, or we cannot be a good Muslim anymore. If you make space, and of course this how much space will be hotly debated, to give people a sense of self, they're much more a cosmopolitan. A true cosmopolitan is also a provincial, I think. And I think that's often seen as contradictory. But I think if you have a sense of self, a small or regional...
A sense of place.
That's in Holland, that's always seen as quite nasty, because it's opening the doors to nationalism, to exclusion of others. But I think it's understood here better that you need to have a sense of self-space to be a better multiculturalist or better cosmopolitan. I think, and that's, I think, is the basis of any discussion about integration, identity, nationalism, and so forth, I think.
Khaled.
Sì. Al di là dell'Islam e dell'Europa, oggi c'è una grande questione che posta al mondo.
Aside from the question of Islam and Europe, there's a big question before the world today.
E il modo con il quale noi risponderemo a questa domanda, le conseguenze saranno molto importanti.
The way that we respond to this will have important consequences.
Questa domanda è una, è semplice nella sua elencazione, ma è difficile nella sua risoluzione.
It's a very simple question to state, but a very difficult one to resolve.
E come vivere insieme?
How to live together.
Quando ero in Parlamento ho molto lavorato sulle questioni di immigrazione e di cittadinanza.
When I was in the Parliament I worked a lot on questions of immigration and citizenship.
Ed integrazione.
And integration as well.
La politica, il trattamento politico è una delle risposte.
Politics and the way politics deals with these is one of the answers.
Ma a monte della politica c'è qualcos'altro.
But aside from politics there's something else.
Questo qualcos'altro ha da fare con la psicologia.
And this something else has to do with psychology.
Con la dimensione affettiva.
With affection, the affective dimension.
Per me significa che in realtà gli uomini, gli esseri umani hanno bisogno di amore.
In reality what this means is that human beings need love.
E senza questo motore affettivo.
And without this affective motor.
È difficile che politicamente noi risolviamo questi problemi.
It will be hard for us to find a political solution to these problems.
E così lasciamo libertà aperta alla violenza e all'odio.
Which would leave the doors wide open to violence and to hatred.
Però sono consapevole.
I'm aware, however,
che siamo in una situazione difficile di pericolo.
That we are in a situation of danger.
E il grande poeta tedesco Hölderlin,
the great German poet Hölderlin,
diceva in un suo verso,
said in one of his poems,
là dove cresce il pericolo,
there where danger grows,
cresce la salvezza.
Salvation grows.
I'm glad you didn't leave us with the word hatred. How do we live? How do we live together? I mean, I think that's basically one of the questions.
I think for several thousand years there's been an answer to that question, and unfortunately it hasn't been love, because there's not enough of that to allow us to live together. The answer has been democracy, and democracy actually is a word that has to do with power. It's about sharing power. The only way to live together is to share power. That's why I come back to the democratic deficit as Europe's problem. Europe's problem now is, more than anything else, a democratic deficit experienced both by Muslims and minorities and immigrants, but also experienced by a lot of traditional working-class folks who feel they're dislocated in a globalizing world, a multicultural world, where their values, their backgrounds are irrelevant, they don't count anymore, and they feel genuinely disempowered. And you have, in fact, two groups on the opposite sides of the political spectrum who share a single experience, and that's the experience of being utterly disempowered, being and thus sharing that they what they share is the democratic deficit. And I guess the crucial question is whether that democratic deficit can be overcome. Part of the democratic deficit has resulted from a fact that we haven't talked about, 30 or 40 years of a market model that has said politics and democracy aren't important, markets solve problems, governments create problems, and that a privatized, commercialized market world is all we need to solve our problems. For anyone who still believes that after the September economic crisis, you know, I can, maybe one of the psychiatrists who was here earlier can offer you some services, but quite clearly the market paradigm as a paradigm of power has failed. And we are back to beginning to understand that government and politics shared power is a way to do it. So the question now becomes, in a way the conundrum we face is it possible to develop a democratic paradigm that includes those from the past who were once, if you like, dominant, those Americans and Dutch and Frenchmen who feel they've lost their history, they've lost their people, they've lost their values because of this new world, and blame it on the newcomers who seem to come with that
so
world.
So they blame it on multiculturalism
because that
in some
seems
ways.
To be part of the problem.
Yeah.
But in fact, multiculturalism is itself a factor, a result of interdependence, a global economy, people following the labor market to where the jobs are. Can these two groups, dislocated on both sides, find a common politics? That's the question. You see, people here kept saying populism, right-wing populism. There are parts of right-wing populism that are very attractive. American fundamentalists on the right at least care about values other than the ones that Hollywood proposes. That's interesting. More importantly, they care about the stewardship of the earth. There are a lot of right-wing
Newt Gingrich is completely obsessed with it.
They also care about economic equality because that comes out of Christian tradition as well. There are things that the left can share with. There are many things we can't share clearly. But finding the commonality, same in Europe. If those who are voting right now, right wing, stop blaming the product of globalization, namely a multicultural Europe, labor immigration from other countries, and begin figuring out what they share in common, namely a common powerlessness and a common democratic deficit in the face of corporations, banks, global markets, and the market mythology, then I think there's the possibility of the kind of politics that Bill Clinton, you know, was trying to imagine that day at Camp David, where he was thinking about a politics where white and poor blacks and poor whites could work together, the kind that Martin Luther King was thinking about. That's why Obama, I think, is such a refreshing, not because finally a black man is in the White House, not even because finally a multiculturalist is in the White House, but because black Americans and white Americans finally voted for someone whose color was not the critical feature. Had it been, he wouldn't have won. But something else was the feature, the sense that he represented something that Americans held in common. And that's why I think his politics seems so promising to Europe, and why the politics of empowerment, the politics of democracy, are crucial. A lot of people attribute our problems to an absence of democracy, or too much democracy, or democracy gone wrong. Jefferson said a long time ago, the remedies for the abuses and ills of democracy is more democracy. And I think what Europe desperately needs right now is more democracy.
Justin.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, but to make this happen, some social, basic social processes have to be changed, and it means educating people differently and socializing differently.
And greater equality between men and women.
Yes, but it's also what you put in the mind of these European citizens. And unfortunately, what's in their mind and what is articulated politically today doesn't reflect this this aspiration toward more democracy. And I think it's part of the issue here. You cannot just have a wishful thinking. There are processes, basic processes. And again, they don't concern Muslims. They concern the whole society. And this is unfortunately not happening right now.
A year ago, Obama looked like wishful thinking.
That the wishful thinking seems to be quite in action. I think that maybe one can use words like wishful thinking.
What I'm saying is there is not, if someone can mention here the equivalent of Obama in any European country, I take it. It's not which doesn't exist.
But you
exist.
Could mention the equivalent of Obama in America 5 years ago. I mean, we didn't have the idea
either. No. It's based on a process of deep change in this society. Look at the way that American society has gone from the 60s to now. It's not just one person talking. It's a deep process of change. And what I'm saying, coming from Europe and living here, I'm not seeing this happening yet in Europe. That's all
and
I'm saying.
And I think the divide is also between America and Europe in this particular conversation.
Definitely. Yeah, but I have a foot in all in both, and I can tell
Moi
you
si.
That
we'll
see.
It grows if there's a climate that allows it to grow.
Mi sembra che sia fondamentale questo clima per far crescere la democrazia.
And this climate is fundamental to make democracy grow.
Ma oggi in Europa c'è un clima di pessimismo.
And today in Europe there's a climate of pessimism.
Che rende la democrazia più complicata.
Which makes democracy even more complicated.
Ecco. Forse Obama è una speranza anche per il mondo.
So, you know, yes, Obama is a hope also for the world in that sense.
Thank you.
I agree, but I think you should be careful, and I agree with you, you should be careful with the language of humanism because it's easily defeated. So there has to be a policy behind it. You know, I've been to India in the slums, and there were... Hindu women, they said, you know, they were very poor, and they said, you know, why this war between Muslims and Hindus? Because the blood in our veins is the same, and we all, of course, agreed. And after 5 minutes, they said, you know, but they're taking all our jobs. So it's very, and I said with Palestinians and Israelis, and they said, you know, we're all human, and they were all agreeing with each other. But the moment you say, now we're going to draw the frontier, it's war again. So I think this language of humanism, and I hope with Obama that it will work, but it's also dangerous in a sense. If he doesn't deliver, if it doesn't, then the reaction will be... With a vengeance, I think.
I just want to say, Obama is not about humanism. It's about politics and interest and a perception of shared interest. And what he did is get a lot of Americans to see that across the boundaries of race that they previously had divided on, they understood there were common interests that allowed him to support him. I'm saying in Europe, too, there are common interests, not yet perceived, to be sure, but when they are, there will be a new politics possible.
Definitely.
Like this politics.
Yeah. You know, and I think you were mentioning Hölderlin, and I'd like to end on a note of Kafka, which I'll invert. Kafka said, there's hope, but not for us. I actually would tend to believe, despite the pessimism and optimism that runs in this panel, that there's hope, and there might be even hope for us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Shall we take questions? A few. If there's an appetite for questions, we'll take a few. Let me say something about questions. Questions are questions rather than comments, and they usually last about 48 seconds. Go ahead.
My question is for the Imam.
Yes.
I'm curious as to whether you think Sharia law has a future in the UK or anywhere else in Europe. If so, in what form?
Thank you.
And if I think is this a good or bad thing?
You will not hear probably in my first interventions on Tuesday that where Sharia is most misunderstood in our part of the world, in Western world, America, in Britain, and also in Europe, Sharia is not about penal code, which sometimes very much misunderstood as well. Sharia is also determine one's life according to the will of God. For example, in Britain, in 2003, the British government have made a Sharia code in economics, and they made one section of Bank of England according to Sharia compliance, in which £32 billion of money coming in Britain from the Muslim world. So that is a Sharia which we want. On marriage, birth, and death, and in hospitals and prisons, it is a something personal law need to be protected, where British Parliament in 1937 and 1939 made a Sharia Act. It is still in our statute. We want that to be implemented in a Muslim private and personal life, which doesn't affect anyone, but Muslims are subject to the law of the land. That's paramount. So Sharia law will not be contradicting to the law of the land.
So that really is paramount. In my opinion, mutuality is needed. Even minorities feel comfortable in the societies where they live and participate under one rule of law, not two rule of law. Sharia law is not a different law. It is the same law which will work with Britain and also Europe, and it will make a lot of progress, and it will help us all and not misunderstanding. Our problem is, as we discussed earlier session, media, and also some, what we call it, ignorant and arrogant politician who doesn't know what they're talking about. And our British media nearly crucified our Archbishop of Canterbury and also to the Exchequer when they mentioned that Sharia is inevitable in the UK because we like the best thing of Sharia to be implemented in Britain. We didn't say it. We didn't ask Archbishop of Canterbury to speak for us, and neither we ask our Exchequer to do for us. They have made their own research, and they find benefit of it. So Sharia should not be frightened by any Western whatsoever, and do not take Taliban or Saudis or other as a best example. They are what we call it smelly eggs, we throw it away. We don't eat smelly egg, we throw them away. For God's sake, don't take bad example of Muslims and implement it on us.
So you don't see any divisive dimension to it at all?
No, not at all. Okay. It's a complementary, it will help, and it is helping Britain. I told you, since 2003, we are getting millions and millions of pounds from abroad for Britain. It's a benefit to Britain.
Okay, I would like to add something on this particular question. I mean, Sharia, the debate is exactly what we're discussing here, very politicized,
yes.
and doesn't reflect the reality of law in all the Muslim countries, in the European countries. I just give you Sharia is already part of the debate in all courts, because
absolutely.
Sharia in Europe, not only in the UK, is about marriage, divorce, custody of children, and finance.
Yeah.
And now, because of the economic crisis, there is a lot of interest of bringing the Islamic finance more prominent,
yeah,
and Islamic banking more prominent, even
true,
for non-Muslims. So
that's
this
right.
is Sharia law in Europe. It would be very misleading to think that Muslims in Europe are claiming the creation of Islamic states.
No.
We have plenty of surveys showing that
yes.
this is not the case.
99%.
There is no, we cannot duplicate what the debate on Islam and state in the Muslim world in the situation of the West.
That's
it doesn't
true.
Work this way.
Absolutely
because
right.
the Muslims in thank you. Muslims
it's great. It feels like
I have a supporter. Muslims in Europe are looking, Sharia doesn't mean cutting heads
no.
and hands.
No.
They are you cross the Muslims. You
it's never
cross,
been practiced even in the Islamic
you cross
world.
The Muslim, there are different ways of the Sharia of Morocco is different from
yeah.
the Sharia of Pakistan and
it's
so on.
Human interpretation
so.
Of sacred
so we should be very and Muslims are aware of that. What they are trying to negotiate, if the divorce, the religious divorce. It's the inheritance, the laws of inheritance, and all that. It doesn't mean that there are no conflicts. There are conflicts.
Of course.
But it's in the family, and it's on equality between men and women in the family. This is a big conflict when it comes to Sharia law, but not the political aspect of it.
One more good question, please.
Human interpretation.
From a former panelist, please.
Yeah, Hasni Abidi from Switzerland. I want just to say something that I think we need more time in Europe because the presence of Muslim in Europe, it's not about 45 years. It's nothing in the time of nations. We need time to make our places. This is point number one. Point number two, I think there is no democratic deficit in Europe. We can be member, we can be elected, we can vote. And this is very important for us. Second point, the third point, when you say that as Muslim, European Muslim, I don't feel the history of cartoons as humiliation for Muslims. I feel the humiliation when I saw the image, picture of Guantanamo Bay, the picture in Abu Ghraib, but the cartoons, in Danish cartoons, it's not humiliating for me, absolutely no. This is maybe form of free expression. I can maybe take maybe something in the, with my lawyer in the justice as a violation to as discrimination, but not as humiliation. This is very important. Please, the phenomenon of Islamic presence in Europe, it's very new. We can't compare the experience in Europe with the experience, for example, of Afro-American in the United States.
Thank After you. That comment, let's take one last question here, right in the front, from one panelist to the other, and make it a great question, no pressure. That's a very great, concise, precise, something that wraps it up, that leaves us both in the middle of pessimism and optimism. Go ahead.
Friedrich Hafes from Vienna, political scientist. I have got one question on Mrs. Jocelyn Cesari. I completely agreed with what you said, that it's the socioeconomic problems that are overlapped by religious discourse. It's not the religious problems. Yes. But I have here one question. You said that Muslims should not see themselves, regard themselves as victims. But actually, in some countries, you have these definitely religious problems Muslims are facing. Take, for instance, the question of wearing the headscarf in school in France. Take, for instance, the ban of wearing a headscarf in different job opportunities, especially in the state in Germany. Take, for instance, the ban of mosques and minarets in two out of nine districts in Austria, and the same debate having begun before that in Switzerland. So out of that, how can a Muslim not see himself as being a victim in some kind? Also, I in general, agree with what you said. Thank you.
when I was talking about victimization is to see yourself as completely deprived of resources despite these difficulties. And I think it's important to keep a sort of proactive mentality. What we have discussed with 500 Muslims across Europe last year. So what came in this discussion was clearly the sense that some people don't even try anymore, while there are resources they can still use, because they think that they're not going to get any kind of promotion or better education because they are Muslim. So they don't even try anymore, in the sense that they are reproducing some kind of malfunction or dysfunction in the place where they live, because they said, what's the point? If I try to get out of the ghetto, nobody is going to give me a chance because I am a Muslim. And there was quite an interesting debate. It was not a dominant trend in the discussion and the groups we convene all across Europe. And there were some other Muslims responding to that and opposing, objecting to that. So I think it's a real debate today among Muslims themselves on that. It's not me putting the victimization on them. It's what came from their own voices. And it was Muslim Voices event. So I wanted to just say that it's not me here talking.
So I would like to thank all the panelists for their attentiveness and the dialogue we had now. I would like to also thank the European Union National Institutes of Cultures. For the last time, I will say it, their acronym is UNIC, and it's been a pleasure working with them. It's been a pleasure working with 19 European countries. As I've said, it's made me age by 19 years, but I feel as though I've learned a lot, and I hope you have as well. Thank you very much.